a Southern writer in the 90s, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for readings and conversation with Mississippi writer Larry Brown. He's here to read from and talk about his novels and short stories.
This story is as close as I can get to one of my idols, Flannery O'Connor. I wanted everything I could get in here. Jesus, Elvis, faith healers, overweight women, sex, incest, truckers, pickups, goats, pistols, sin and faith and redemption. It took me a week to write it and 8 months to get it to where it is now, and it's about as Southern as I can get.
Writer Larry Brown describing one of his recent stories, one entitled A Roadside Resurrection. Larry Brown will be back in just a moment with readings and conversation. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Major funding for this program comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund. Although American society is becoming more uniform, the South retains a cultural distinctiveness unlike any other part of the country. The same thing can be said of a new generation of Southern writers whose work portrays social change, but also reflects a literary heritage as palpable as a steamy Southern summer night. In an exploration of the ideas and images of recent Southern writing, Soundings now presents the second segment in an occasional series of programs. My guest now is Larry Brown, winner of the 1992 Southern Book Critics Circle Award and the Mississippi Institute of Arts and Letters Award in 1989. To paraphrase another Mississippi writer, William Faulkner, Larry Brown's fiction shows how the past continues to shape the present. Brown is the author of 2 collections of stories, 5 novels, and a play. Before he started writing full-time, Larry Brown was a captain in the Oxford, Mississippi Fire Department. He sees Southerners living through hard knocks and emotional chaos. But Brown's fiction, however bleak, also offers a margin of hope and humor. In one story, entitled A Roadside Resurrection, he presents both a parody and an affirmation of Southern life. A Roadside Resurrection is an account of a legendary faith healer, a woman named Flenko who searches for physical salvation for her dying husband, and a family harboring a human monstrosity who embodies the darkest side of the Southern grotesque. Larry Brown.
Yeah, that's the first story that I wrote after I left the fire department. And it did take me about a week initially to write it, but I wound up working on it for 8 months before I got it right because I kept finding out more and more things I wanted to say. And it's probably, people have called it, wild and crazy and all this kind of stuff. And I guess that's true. I had a really wonderful time writing that story. In this story, I was trying to make a really bizarre situation that was believable.
Let me tell you succeeded.
And at the same time, I wanted the structure of it. I wanted these two stories that were combined within one story, the story of the healer and the story of Flenko and her husband, who never quite made their connection. That's part of the futility of the story. Part of it is the futility of her search for this thing that she hopes to accomplish, and then the situation that the healer gets himself thrown into just out of the goodness of his acts.
Yeah, this incredible character or monstrosity that he runs into. I want to come back to that in a moment. Larry, are you making fun of religious faith in this story? I mean, it's possible to read it at that and come away from it with that sort of feeling. How about it?
To me, the story is about faith. Mm-hmm. As an affirmation of faith.
And this guy really is a healer.
He really is a healer. He really does have the power. But to get to that, I had to construct what I thought was a believable event, which was a cold water drowning, which, just being a firefighter, I knew about that people can survive that. And that faith, can do things, because you hear about all these things that go on. You hear about people who handle snakes and get bitten and survive and all the other miracles that are performed, And so it's partly about all that. It's part of the mystery of the South, some of the things that, that go on down here that we pretty much take for granted.
Yeah, you have a passage where you say that there are people and things in the backwoods of the South that are, I guess, primitive. Primeval is the right word to use. And this character, this deformed monstrosity of a son that belongs to these two old people who want the faith healer to work on this kid. That's one of them. Now, I've got a friend here at work who read that story and said, hey, listen, what this guy is writing about here is original sin. I mean, this demonstrates that people in the South still believe in sin, in the fallibility of humankind. Is that too much of a stretch?
No, I don't think it is. No, I don't think it is. And, you know, I'm aware that people like this exist because of the place that I live in. You can still find people living in very primitive conditions. You can still find people living without electricity in their homes, without running water, living like people lived 100 years ago.
Now, what do you want us to come away from this story, a roadside resurrection feeling? Or what? I mean, let's use a crude word here, a message, a theme. What's going on in your mind?
Well, I really don't consciously, I don't believe, have a theme whenever I'm working on something. I think whatever it is that the story says eventually works its way out through the telling of the story.
So it's up to the reader, is that it? You're just going to let us make up our own minds?
To me, the thing is about not only, you know, a person having faith not being rewarded, but a person who has lost his faith being reaffirmed. You know, Flinko's case and the healer's case.
Right.
To me, and it's an example of each.
All right. Larry, let's talk about your work as a Southern writer. It's always great fun to try to figure out how you connect with the Southern tradition, how you come out of it. Let me put it to you this way. How much has the South changed over the past 20 or 30 years? And how has that, to the degree that you have experienced those changes or you believe in them, how does that work on you as a writer?
Well, one thing that I've seen as far as physical changes in the land is probably what has impressed me the most, such as the reduction of acreage that's being farmed, the reduction of a lot of the hardwood timber that was once in around everywhere, where a lot of it has been clear-cut, logged off, and now is in pine plantations, as well as the growth of the industry.
So, in other words, the landscape itself makes a difference in the mind of a writer such as yourself.
Yeah, I believe that it does, yeah, because once it gets changed, I believe that it's changed irrevocably, that you can't go back to the way that it was before.
What about social change? I mean, for example, I'm going to ask you to read here in a moment from Dirty Work, one of your books. What about the experience of Vietnam and the war? Does that have a particularly Southern resonance for you?
I think probably the thing that's happening is that the South is becoming more like the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. I believe it's becoming harder to distinguish it the way it was, say, 30 years ago.
Until somebody comes along and reads with the characters you create in Roadside Resurrection.
Yeah. Talking about stuff like that, I guess I probably just have a vision sometimes of the way that I want things to be in a fictional manner, or maybe I shouldn't say that, but I guess I just kind of place things so that they work out in the way I want them to for my stories, and use that landscape and all.
Let's listen to some of your work here, Larry Brown. I want you to read to me from Dirty Work. This is a passage where one character, Walter, wakes up in a hospital and recognizes the man that he's basically going to talk to for the rest of this book, and his name is Braden Cheney. Read for me.
Okay. He was a bro when he was looking at me, studying me when I opened my eyes, like he'd been watching me for a long time just to see how long it would take. Somehow his eyes smiled, but I had to suck in a big breath when I saw the rest of him. He didn't have any arms or legs, just nubs, just like Johnny got his gun. He winked at me long and slow, said, "Hey, man, what's happening?" I just shook my head. I didn't know what was happening or what had happened. I felt kind of dizzy, and when I tried to raise up, my head felt like it was spinning. I felt like I didn't have any control over my head. So he's back down on the pillow. They'd shot me with some kind of stuff, evidently. Something that would keep me calm and make me be a good boy. I wondered if maybe I hadn't been a good boy already. I wondered if I'd messed up. I probably had. I do that pretty frequently. Usually about every day. That's how I get by. I knew I'd just have to lie there until the stuff wore off, whatever it was. It wasn't a bad drug. It was sort of nicely numbing. I looked at the guy again. He had his head turned, watching me. He had a very gentle gaze, not hostile at all. He got to grinning, and I got to grinning too. I felt kind of loopy and loose. But I also wondered how he could be in such good spirits. Finally, he said he was just kidding me, but they had given me something to cool me out. I didn't know what he was talking about, and he said I'd been a bad boy and didn't want to go along with the program.
It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You're listening to the second segment in an occasional series of programs spotlighting the work of contemporary Southern writers. My guest on this program is Larry Brown. During the time he worked as a captain in the Oxford, Mississippi Fire Department, Larry Brown wrote dozens of short stories, five novels, and a play. In 1990, he left the fire department to write full-time. His collections include Facing the Music and Big Bad Love. His first published novel, Dirty Work, won the Mississippi Institute of Arts and Letters Award for Fiction. Reading from one of his collections of stories, Big Bad Love, here's Larry Brown.
My dog died. I went out there in the yard and looked at him, and there he was, dead as a hammer. Boy, I hated it. I knew I'd have to look around and see about a shovel. But it didn't look like he'd been dead long, and there wasn't any hurry, and I was wanting a drink somewhat. So I went on out a little further into the yard to see if my truck would crank, and it would, so I left. Thought I'd bury the dog later, before Mildred got home. Figured I had plenty of time. Birds were singing, flowers were blooming. It was just wonderful. I hated for my old dog to be dead and miss all that, but I didn't know if dogs cared about stuff like that or not. I didn't have a whole lot of gas in my truck. I didn't figure I needed to get started riding and drinking. I thought I'd just ride over and get something to drink and then ride back, sit on the porch and maybe cut my toenails until Mildred nearly got home, then start burying the dog to occupy myself.
Now, if we subtracted the wonderful way you talk, that great Mississippi accent, and had you read that passage from Big Bad Love again, would it be especially Southern? I mean, is there anything particularly regional going on here?
Probably not. Probably just purely rural, but it could be rural Michigan, as far as I'm concerned, in this particular story, yeah, because I think a lot of my stuff could be set just about anywhere where I'm talking about, where the South doesn't particularly have an influence on the story. I like to think that they could be set in other places, too.
Now, one way to come to your fiction, Larry Brown, is to say that you write as much about questions of class and social station in this country as you do about another of our big questions, probably one of the biggest questions that we face socially, and that's race. Mm-hmm. How do you come to that that interplay in your books?
Well, I try to to explore everything from everybody's point of view, whether it's a white person, a black person, a child, a woman, and an elderly person, just whomever I'm concerned with, the character I'm creating. And I try to get inside that person's head and know as much about them as I can.
How do you know when you've created the voice that you want to hear coming to you off the page?
Well, I believe that it's established very early in any piece of work. I know when I wrote Kabuki Rides, one of my short stories about a black lady who drinks too much years ago, I knew within two lines that I had established the rhythm and the flow and the sound of that story, and that everything else had to follow those first two lines.
Now, that story opens with Alan come in the door, the mm-hmm. husband's coming home, mm-hmm. and this woman realizes that she's a drunk, she hates mm-hmm. it, mm-hmm. but she can't get away from it, and now she's got to face her husband.
Right. Yeah, and that I could hear, sometimes I hear this voice in my head, and I just have to kind of trust it and follow it.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, I try to assume different voices. I try to assume a different voice for every story.
When you write, for example, in a room by yourself, do you actually say these words, or is it all on the interior?
I have before, yeah. Usually I will say something aloud to test the dialogue. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's to
wonderful.
Me, that's the hardest thing to get right is the dialogue, you know, to make it sound like me and you talking.
Just sitting here talking. I want you to read to me again, Larry Brown. This time you're going to read from one of your stories called, this is a story in Facing the Music, which is a collection of your stories. And here is a passage from Samaritans. Read to me again.
Okay. I was smoking my last cigarette in a bar one day around the middle of the afternoon. I was drinking heavy, too, for several reasons. It was hot and bright outside and cool and dark inside the bar, so that's one reason I was in there. But the main reason I was in there was because my wife had left me to go live with somebody else. A kid came in there unexpectedly, a young kid, and of course that's not allowed. You can't have kids coming in bars. People won't put up with that. I was just on the verge of going out to my truck for another pack of smokes when he walked in. I don't remember who all was in there. Some old guys, I guess, and probably some drunks. I know there was one old man, a golfer, who came in there every afternoon with shaky hands, drank exactly 3 draft beers, and told these crummy, dirty jokes that would make you just close your eyes and shake your head without smiling if you weren't in a real good mood. And back then, I was never in much of a good mood. I knew they'd tell that kid to leave. But I don't think anybody much wanted to. The kid didn't look good. I thought there was something wrong the minute he stepped in. He had these panicky eyes.
Larry Brown, we've just heard you read from one of your stories called Samaritans. This is in your collection, Facing the Music. What's going on here? You're creating a scene of sympathy and empathy between a man and a boy. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, starting off with a character whose wife has left him and he's hanging out in a bar because he really doesn't have anything else to do. And just through accident or, you know, through circumstances, things often happen. He becomes involved with these people in this old beat-up car who don't have any money and are really, you know, downtrodden and down on their luck. And he's sympathetic to their plight, and he thinks they probably need money for food and for gas. They're headed west, you know, and ends up just being totally conned by these people. And I don't know if there's really a message that I'm trying to say. Some people have said that it's a story about the futility of trying to lend people a helping hand.
Larry, you know, just to generalize about the shape of your fiction, Dirty Work, Big Bad Love, Facing the Music, your novel, Joe, it's pretty grim stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, I could look at you and say, come on, you're just having fun with this. You're just trying to do a send-up of really how bad things can get.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side, I might look at you and say, you really believe this. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really are as pessimistic as this stuff and as comic, you know, all of that that darker side of comedy. Mm-hmm. Who is the real Larry Brown here speaking to us from these books?
Well, I think what I probably try to explore are the inner strengths of people and how much people can take and survive. But that is why I make things so hard on my characters. You know, it's been said that I sandbag them before, which is true.
Absolutely.
I learned that a long time ago, but that works in two different ways. One, if you hook your reader early with what's going on, you've got him. And what you're trying to do is make him forget that he's reading. I want people to be able to get into situations that possibly they've never encountered and, you know, come away changed by what they've read.
But doesn't that create a responsibility for you? Doesn't that put a sort of a responsibility on your shoulders? You know, people come to you and say, hey, this story changed my life. This made me see the world through different eyes. How about that?
I've had comments like that before, and I have had people come up to me and say, this story you wrote is about my life. And that'll make you think twice.
Well, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Larry Brown. We're talking about your fiction. I want you to read to me here a passage from your novel, Joe. This is the very opening part of the book. Very, very quickly, tell me just the shape of the novel, and then we'll listen to you read.
Yeah, it's about two different groups of people. Well, there's a group of people who are walking down the road, and then there's another character named Joe, who meets this little boy in this family and kind of befriends him. Joe has lost his family. This other family doesn't have any home. And the two meet, and eventually that's what the whole story of the novel evolves out of. The road lay long and black ahead of them, and the heat was coming now through the thin soles of their shoes. There were young beans pushing up from the dry brown fields, tiny rows of green sprigs that stretched away in the distance. They trudged on beneath the burning sun, but anyone watching could have seen that they were almost beaten. They passed over a bridge spanning a creek that held no water, and as their feet sounded weak drum beats, erratic and small in the silence that surrounded them. No cars passed these potential hitchhikers. The few rotting houses perched on the hillsides of snarled vegetation were broken-backed and listed, discarded dwellings where dwelled only field mice and owls. It was as if no one lived in this land, or ever would again, but they could see a red tractor toiling in a field far off, silently, a small dust cloud following. The two girls and the woman had weakened in the heat. Sweat beaded the black down on their upper lips. They each carried paper sacks containing their possessions, all except the old man, who was known as Wade, and who carried nothing but the ragged red bandana that he mopped against his neck and head to staunch the flow of sweat that had turned his light blue shirt a darker hue. Half of his right shoe sole was off, and it flopped and folded beneath his foot so that he managed a sliding, shuffling movement with that leg, picking it up high in a queer manner before the sole flopped again. The boy's name was Gary. He was small, but he carried the most. His arms were laden with shapeless clothes, rusted cooking utensils, mildewed quilts and blankets. He had to look over the top of them as he walked, just to be able to see where he was going. The old man faltered momentarily, did a drunken two-step, and collapsed slowly on the melted tar with a small grunt, easing down so as not to hurt himself. He lay with one forearm shielding his face from the eye of the sun. His family went on without him. He watched them growing smaller in the distance, advancing through the mirrored heat waves that shimmied in the road, unfocused wavering shakes with long legs and little heads.
Larry Brown, we've just heard you read from the opening passage of your novel, Joe. Is it important that we understand whether this book has a happy ending or a sad ending? Do you deal in that kind of language in your own mind when you write these stories?
Yeah, and I had probably a tougher time writing the ending of this novel than I had any other one, simply because I was undecided as to what fate Wade should have, who I had tried to make as despicable and disgusting and dirty and
man, you did it. You did it. This is one of the meanest people I have read about in fiction in a long time.
Yeah, to me, the whole thing is basically a battle between good and evil.
And, do you see the world in those terms, Larry?
I do.
Pretty stark contrast.
Pretty stark. Yeah, I believe that evil exists in the world. There's no mistake about it.
Is that because you have a particular set of religious beliefs? Anything that's especially Southern at work here, or how did all of that come together?
Nah, I think it's probably just so much stuff that exists not only in my state or the South or our country, but the world. Mm-hmm. All the ways that mankind can't get along and has never been able to get along. And, you know, I said one time in Dirty Work, you know, Jesus said there has always been wars and there's always going to be wars. And I guess the futility of that is one thing that I try to kind of explore. You know, I believe people ought to love each other a lot more than what they do.
Do you think that your books move us in the direction of that kind of harmony? Is that too much of an exaggeration to put that at your doorstep?
No, I'm trying to create a world that you know is never going to be perfect, but in which people try to do their best with what they've been given.
Mm-hmm. Larry Brown, I want to thank you very much for coming by the National Humanities Center to participate in our series on contemporary Southern writers. Let me tell our listeners about you. Larry Brown, the short story writer, the novelist. Your books include Facing the Music, Dirty Work, Big Bad Love. Your most recent book is Joe. You got a couple of screenplays in the works, and you're, about next spring we can look forward to a book about your experiences as a firefighter.
February, they say.
February of 94.
Uh-huh.
All right. Larry, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I appreciate your coming by to be on our program on Soundings, and I wish you well in your work.
Well, thanks a lot, Wayne. Good to see you again.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In just a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. You've been listening to the second segment in an occasional series of programs spotlighting the work of contemporary Southern writers. My guest was Larry Brown. Upcoming segments will include Jill McCorkle, Clyde Edgerton, Lee Smith, Brent Wade, Dory Sanders, Tim McLaurin, Tina McElroy-Anza, Randall Keenan, Kay Gibbons, and Robert Olin Butler. For an audio tape of this program, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 687. That's program number 687, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. The music you heard on this show is from an album entitled The Devil's Dream and featured the Tarwater Band. Special thanks for assistance in the production of this program go to Richard Schramm and Patricia Schreiber at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings on Contemporary Southern Writing came from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.